Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello everybody, and happy Tuesday night. Hope everybody is hunkered down here in Austin as the weather has turned nasty this evening. We'll be talking to a couple of great Austin folks, Damian Shalasi and Nicole Ricardo, here in just a few minutes. They were the hosts and organizers of the Strange and Extraordinary Fest that happened here in Austin. They are also the co-founders of the Peripeculiar Museum, which is a traveling exhibit full of all kinds of haunted items, things like that. We'll be getting into that tonight. In the second part, we will be joined by our good friend who we have not had on in oh so long, Dan Duke, who lives right up the road, actually. We will be talking about his familial connection to Jesse James and the faking of Jesse James's death, how he came here to Texas and buried treasure. Man, it is an incredible story. I'm here to tell you right now, folks. And I am really excited to have our guests on during this segment, because I am all about, as you know, events. That's what I do for a living, especially things like paranormal events. So much so that, like, I started a company that does paranormal events, because I am personally of the mind that all too many organizers of these events do not know of each other's events. And they happen right on top of each other. Like, even the same weekend as Strange and Extraordinary Fest, there was Myth and Monsters happening up the road, all kinds of things. So it's interesting to me how many of these events are out there. I have assembled a huge compendium of them over at Curious Events. You can stop on by, check that out. The interactive map is coming soon, but it's literally, there are tons of events. When you get into it, there's probably about 75 events that happen here in Texas alone, dealing with everything from psychics to UFOs, UAPs, cryptozoology, and the paranormal. So welcome to the show, Damian and Nicole. How are you guys doing this evening?
Good.
Looks like it's about to storm, so we're happy about that.
Right? Well, here in Texas, we can always use the rain. But even after the crazy rains last year, it's like, really? Again? And it was right up around this time last year.
Yeah, we love a stormy evening, which is what it looks like we're in store for, so.
Exactly. Well, speaking of stormy things, speaking of things that, you know, send chills up people's spines, hey, how did you guys come to the world of paranormal to begin with? Nicole, let's start with you.
Oh, well, that's a loaded question. I mean, for me, I've been a weirdo since I was a kid, to be honest with you. And I always blame one of my aunts, because when I was growing up, she would always tell me these scary stories and ghost stories, haunted stories. So she really fed that addiction. So I very quickly became, you know, one of those kids where when I was asking for a bedtime story, I was not asking for, you know, Beauty and the Beast. I was asking for a ghost story.
Yeah.
So I was just a little weirdo. And then I had my first paranormal experience when I was 8 years old. And I mean, that pretty much, you know, that sucks you into the rabbit hole. So from then on, I've been interested and have, you know, watched all of the shows and paranormal movies and things of that nature. And then when I finally moved over to Austin, I finally found a friend who was willing to go do spooky things with me. So, then I started doing it.
And, you know, that is the typical arc of people who get into this, is that somewhere along the line, they had an experience themselves, or they had a very open-minded family that encouraged them to, like, my mom was open-minded enough to understand I was a kid reading a book. She should be happy I was reading a book, you know. So what if it was about vampires or werewolves or myths or legends or amulets? She really didn't care, as long as it wasn't like something horrible, you know. And what about you, Damien? How did you come to the world of para in your life?
Yeah, most of my time growing up, my realm was the sort of conspiracy theory world, which leads to strangeness, things like UFOs, looking at that phenomena, etc. Fast forward, though, to being an adult, as someone who also collects oddities and antiques, my very first time that I had someone tell me that an item that I was getting was haunted, for me, it was just kind of silly. It was kind of a joke. And then I had little experiences with it, which then started an obsession of reaching out to people who thought they were going through this phenomenon itself, people that thought maybe they had items that were haunted, and collecting their stories, which turned into them giving me their items. And that then turned into a obsession / collection.
Wow. Wow. And you know, the idea of especially collecting haunted items, you know, there are not a lot of people who would bring such an item into their care necessarily. Correct. Damien, and I'm one of those people, like I have said for years openly on this show, got no problem with people who have them. I probably won't have a Ouija board in my house.
No.
That's just me. Got a copy of the Roman Ritual, got all kinds of things in my house. You know, hold a crystal in my hand while I host the show, all kinds of things. But it's one of those, even when it comes to CE5 and that kind of stuff, I am very much an intent rules the day kind of person. And yeah, Hopefully that intent is there, but it doesn't necessarily mean that whatever's coming through ain't playing Captain Howdy and trying to make you think there's something friendly, you know, yeah. So.
Great reference, by the way.
Thank you.
Really, really great reference. with the Captain Howdy. And it's funny. I mean, I'm looking over here in our living room.
At your Ouija boards?
Yeah. I mean, like, we literally have a great collection of really good examples of Ouija boards. So we have them all up kind of along on the walls so you can see them on display and everything else. But yeah, to your point, the whole Captain Howdy piece of it, for anyone listening, I hope you get that reference. If not, you were probably raised wrong. that is actually something that we do talk about a lot. This idea of intent and trying to understand that we don't really typically know what it is exactly that we're dealing with, even when it tells us what it may or may not be.
Yeah, we have dealt a lot personally with masquerading spirits, if you will, or
absolutely.
Something.
Absolutely.
Pretending to be something else. Yeah, we have experienced that often.
I mean, to the point where I would say, I guess I can't say 100% of the time, but I would say the majority of the time of these things that we experience and these things that happen in our world is probably that.
Interesting, because I say it so much on this show that I literally have a rote phrase whenever I present the concept on the show. And that is, I believe that there is a large hominid creature roaming the woods of North America and beyond known as Sasquatch. But I also think that there is something else that is fully willing to take the trope of our minds and our want of experience and use that as a point of ingress to this dimension. That could be spiritually, that could be UFO wise, that could be, I'm against a tree and I'm waiting to see a Bigfoot. It's perfectly using or willing to use that trope of your want of experience as a point of entry, no different than leaving the window open for the vampire, so to speak.
No, you're right. And to sort of piggyback on that.
Sure.
Not only is that something that does seem to do that, to sort of reach into the consciousness and find out how is best for us to engage it.
Yeah.
But it also seems to, at least since antiquity, also shape cultures and realities, to the point where the more you look at this, you start to think, maybe we're not really in control of what we think and how societies work anymore these days, because it seems to be what directs us if you really look at the phenomenon, the history leading up. So,
no, and that's a fascinating point to bring up. I'm actually speaking this year at MUFON, at their symposium coming up in August, and part of what I'm talking about is the way that UFOs have moved humanity. The way that they are moving humanity right now, not just technologically, but ethnographically, the way it's moving us spiritually, the divides that it's creating, even within the UFO UAP community. You know, just the idea that the article came out and people were all kerfuffle about it in the communities that FBI, or not FBI, but alphabet agencies use stories from within the UFO UAP community as cover for their projects.
Yes.
It's like, well, yeah. Why wouldn't they? You're doing their work for them. Like, they no longer need somebody to come up with a cover story. We're doing a great job within the community ourselves.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting point, because what seems to kind of have been happening up until now is you have disclosure and you have the communities and you have the people looking at the phenomena. And if you can sprinkle in truths with a bunch of lies, like 10% of disclosure is true, and then, you know, 90% of it is just made up, really, you start to understand how difficult it really is to look at the phenomena because of that. Have you ever seen a documentary called Mirage Men?
Yes.
Okay. That right there is we're big on that one. I mean,
well, yeah. I mean, I was just going to say, I mean, at this point, we know factually this is not, you know, conspiracy, or our cat just fell off the windowsill anyway. government agents will infiltrate these like conventions or societies, communities to plant false information, you know?
Well, and you know, what's funny is the first getting ready to do a show, folks, just so you know, on the whole government files that have been released. We did some culling of files in the first batch. We're doing that right now, where all the videos and photos will be conglomerated separately in an easy document. But the first document that was released in that first trove recently on May 8th, the first document was literally a document from a gentleman to J. Edgar Hoover. And the gentleman was like, hey, I'm a part of this UFO research society. This is what we do. This is what we're into. Like, we had a symposium this last year, and this is what we talked about. I want to be very clear, that I don't want you to label me a communist.
Yeah. I read that. Yeah.
Because of this. One. Well, like, that's the first document that they released, was the government literally targeting people and labeling them as things.
Yes. Well, you have that lady. It's in the documents as well. And of course, I think she was writing to Hoover as well. And to be honest, if I were ever in that time period and writing a letter to J. Edgar Hoover, I'd probably be like, not a communist. Every other sentence, you know, it's J. Edgar Hoover. But, you know, it's funny about that you bring that up, because just like you, we, when the files were released, that day, you know, we are not happy to just look through them. We started printing all of them, our hard copies.
Oh, yeah, everything. Yeah. Absolutely.
So, funny story, though, we're doing that literally the second it gets released. Like, we're printing out because we know how this goes. And we said it was going to happen, and it did. Yeah. As you were printing the files, some of them started being like, oh, file not found. It's like, okay. It's almost like Epstein file stuff. You know, like, the files get released, and all of a sudden, redacted.
Yeah. Yeah, so. No, and you know, it's interesting, because one of the things I say on the show regularly is since the proving of quantum entanglement, science and even the government has run to the world of para, be it UFO, UAP, Psi. I'm pretty heavily embedded in the Psi community and things like that. They have hard run to these communities that have been researching these things for a long time, because they all seem to cross over in certain areas, and it's fascinating. You know, one of the things I say regularly is it's interesting when you have Bigfoot and orbs At which phenomena do you begin the investigation?
Well, if you're
the orbs, the portal, or Bigfoot?
Yeah, if you were to ask us, probably all three sort of together.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. And let's start getting into that, and specifically some of the things that y'all talk about whenever you're out on the road. Sure. And the way that y'all go about investigation into these things.
Well, we are big on, you know, if you ask Damien, he would say it's all the same thing. For me, I think it's a little bit more nuanced. But yes, sure. we are very big on looking at the patterns of things. And this also ties into, you know, you mentioned our fest, Strange and Extraordinary Fest. That is literally why we started it, because in our opinion, you know, the paranormal people stay in their own little paranormal bubble, and the Bigfoot guys stay over here in Bigfoot world, and the UFO UAP guys are going to the UFO conferences. But we're like, okay, well, when you look at the patterns and you look at the research and you look at things that some of the very serious academics, even the work that they're doing, people like Dana Pasulka, you know, and finding all of these patterns where things overlap and things intersect, we're like, we need more spaces where all of the weirdos are sitting together at the same table and discussing these things together. So that way we can find where the overlaps are. And I think more often than not, we are talking about a lot of the same things. We're all just describing it in different ways, or we're calling it something different.
Well, which is interesting, because if we look at, when we talked about earlier, how the phenomena seems to shape our reality, our world.
Yeah.
This couldn't be further from the truth. And if you look what's happening right now with the UAP world. So first off, someone at my age, and I'll age myself, right? I'm 44. So
darn,
for
50.
Barry, I'm sorry?
I'm 50. It's okay.
Yeah, there you go. You got me beat by a little bit. So then you know what I'm talking about. Like being younger in the 90s, like late 80s, and getting into conspiracy theories and stuff, UFO phenomena. Honestly, it wasn't until like maybe a handful of years ago that you could even talk about that without being like labeled a conspiracy theorist or labeled a kook or whatever. But what's funny is if you look at what's happening now with the UAP thing, more UAP sightings are happening now than ever. They're just like in the sky all of a sudden, just everywhere. It seems to be a new age. This is going to get kind of deep and wild, but it almost seems like a new age is coming, and the new version of religion and spirituality is coming. And it's part of the technological age, which is why we're now dealing with craft in the sky versus seraphim and angels in the sky.
Sure, sure. And you know, it's the whole concept of any technology that's high enough would be indistinguishable from magic. The only difference is we call it technology, not magic.
Correct.
You know, and the example I give all the time is the thumb drives I have laying around. We know what that's for. We know what it's about. We know what they can store and what's on them. You take that, you lose it on a beach for 50 years, 60 years. You know, like you got kids running around, don't know what an 8-track tape is.
That's a sad story.
You know, they're just reorganizing what vinyl and actual tape is. Like cassette tapes are back now, which is a musician I love. But
I love it too, except now they're $30 for a cassette tape.
Yeah,
it used to be,
if you were smart like me, you had a backstock. I always had them for my 4-track player. So
you bring up something interesting, because I don't know if you know the story. The name escapes me of the tribe, and anyone can look this up. It's super easy to find. It's pretty well known. But there was a indigenous tribe somewhere in the world that we had flown helicopters over, I think surveying, whatever. And the tribes people come out, you know, they're throwing spears at the helicopter, whatever. Years later, we go back and they had built like a monument to the helicopter, like a deity. Because they have no idea like what is flying in the sky. To them, it's a big, loud monster. And that's always been really compelling and interesting to me, because that to these people was paranormal phenomena, because they'd never seen it before.
Yeah. Those are the cargo cults of World War II.
There you go. Yeah.
Where they had never seen supply planes, things like that. All they knew that was this dude came up and jumped out of a bird and a whole bunch of stuff came out. And
that's
like
right.
we didn't have to struggle that year. Please come back, Big Bird. You know, So yeah. And it's interesting because that is once again not far in our past. And I normally give the cultural point just as a Cajun of exactly how long it takes to forget something like a language, like one generation, man. Yeah. That's all it takes. You find very, like, my mother understands a few words. You would be hard pressed to find somebody in my family who is fluent in Cajun, whereas both of my grandparents were.
Yeah.
And
I mean, I see it these days. I don't even know what the kids are saying out there. I hear words all the time.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What is that? You know,
well, that's just because we're old. But quite literally, it's the fact of when you start looking at these things through that cultural lens. You know, the prime example is my father's 72. He has zero interest, and he's the example I typically give whenever we're talking about the declassification of files, whenever we're talking about the hearings that are happening. They are for folks like us who research these things and have seen most of these videos released on websites, things like that, over the last decade. We've seen most of these documents. These are for the people who are like my dad. Oh, what the hell are you talking about, little green men? Why are we wasting all this time in Congress talking about that? It's like, well, because apparently they've spent billions of your dollars researching it.
Well, not only that, when you have something in your airspace that you have no idea what it is, that is the biggest. For a government to be able to admit, hey, there's something flying around our airspace. We don't know what it is.
And can't defend against
and
it.
And can't defend against it.
Can barely detect it.
Yeah, you know, so that's why they should be talking about it.
Well, and that's just it, though. And that's what's interesting is that when it comes to all of these things, once again, we are very prone to a couple of things. A, there is the immediate fear of things, of not understanding. The immediate fear of not understanding something that is far, far beyond your grasp, or that shakes the foundation of your own personal cultural belief, you know, to a point where, like, cognitive dissonance occurs and you will just not accept new data into the system. You know, like, absolutely not. There's no way that can be, you know. Yeah. And
like the story of the one of the early cinemas and the movies, and it was a train coming towards the screen, and people ran out of that theater.
Yeah.
Because they thought a train was barreling towards them.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That's kind of the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, even whenever you're talking about the roots of experience, that idea once again that, and I bring it up regularly, especially with curious research, the idea of charging an environment, the idea of if you're going to research a location, you shouldn't be like deep diving into the history of it the night before. You shouldn't be going into lore and watching videos online about it. Like, you should have a rote checklist of gear. You know, we have the map, all that kind of stuff. And then put it away. Because once again, the more you're diving into it, A, the more you're kind of polishing the filter through which you're going to look at data that you're gathering. And B, you may very well be charging that environment to what you're wanting to experience.
That's 100%. I think to piggyback on that, I mean,
please,
you can go into a place that, you know, allegedly haunted, whatever, has the stories. You can go in there even without ever knowing anything about the place, looking at it. But the phenomena itself, potentially, probably already charged from so many other people that have been in there looking at the same thing, that the phenomena will present to you in that way. Mm. If I'm articulating
like
that properly.
Egregores, basically.
Yeah.
Thought forms. Yeah. But yeah, to your point, I mean, that we do try to do that. I mean, whenever we do investigations, at least, you know, official investigations for the podcast, I mean, like almost 100% of the time I go in blind. If I don't, we note it. But, and then typically if we have somebody else doing the research, which now we do, shout out to R&R Productions. Yeah, then Damien will go in blind as well, because it's just, you know, for me, at least for when we investigate, I feel like it just makes it a lot more compelling too, when we have, you know, something that I might pick up on that also then ends up lining up with what we get during the investigation. And then you go in and you start digging through the history and you realize, oh, actually this all lines up with this history here, what actually occurred. Yeah. It just, for me personally, makes it a lot more compelling, I think.
Yes, but when it gets really, really compelling, I would say, is when you go in and you have phenomena that lines up with the history of the place, okay? But then
you find out it's wrong.
Yes. So then you do the deep dive and you find out the history was completely fabricated. And people don't really realize this. That is going on more often than you think. Most of the big historic hotels I've been at that have the haunted ghost tour, that everyone sees the apparition, is typically like some little girl or woman in white, right? Nine times out of 10, I found that those stories never existed. Yet people are having this experience of that phenomenon specific to those stories.
Yeah.
Find that very fascinating.
Well, and you know, that brings up a truly sad part of all these communities, which is that want of experience, that true deep want of experience. And that's the biggest example I give of that as caveat within the communities is Corey Good, because people wanted that experience so bad that they had that experience and then come to find out, no, Corey was lying. That his experiences were fabricated. And like he said in his deposition, anybody who said they had this experience, is delusional.
Well, now that's a good one. That one gets me going a little bit. And I love this topic because there is a group that we were listening to one time speak. And they were talking about, I'm sure everyone here listening remembers when Dybbuk boxes, like, were the thing, right? Like, the whole story of the Dybbuk box. And you've got one in the Zach Bagans Museum that, like, apparently caused Post Malone to have an airplane crash or something. Here's the deal. So these people we were listening to, also collectors, and they were talking about how around the time that story broke, they got their hands on one of these, quote, Dybbuk boxes. Well, they started having phenomena around this item that they had. And it did not stop until they found out that the Dybbuk box story was completely made up and fabricated. So to your point of, sure. of this guy saying that maybe they were delusional or whatever, I think we simplify it when we look at it that way. I think what's mainly probably happening is the phenomena is being generated based off of, call it beliefs or cultural whatever, or intent even, right? It's almost like the phenomena, it's an anchor, interest and intent. So whatever it is, they'll kind of grab it and run with it. So I think
totally. And once again, it's that want of experience. And it's something that we talk about all the time. It's something I'll be talking about at MUFON this year is why are you investigating? To begin with, you know, like, are you investigating as a researcher? You know, whenever I go to research a topic, it always begins with true curiosity. I'm curious about an experience I heard about, something like that. And from there, I wear my skeptic hat. You know, I am pretty well founded in science and logic, things like that. I've had my religious experiences in life. I've had my paranormal experiences. Which is why I'm open to all the ideas and all the concepts, because you kind of have to be. I mean, my religious experience that I had at like 15, 16 years old may someday be proven to be a petit mal seizure. That doesn't remove the experience. It doesn't, just because somebody's shown you what's inside of your red circle and can prove what's inside the red circle, doesn't remove the moment of experience. It doesn't remove your moment of questioning reality, wanting to know more. That's literally the scientific method, just from the point of view of an experiencer.
Yeah. And I think to your point of maybe one day, you know, you'll discover that, you know, what had happened was a type of seizure and what have you. I think what's happened though is the world of the materialist, the material science crowd, they'll see that, and then all of a sudden everything goes to your brain has made it up. It's
trying to write it off.
Yeah, it's an illusion, whatever that your brain has made up. But now with all the new people researching consciousness itself, we're starting to understand, I think, as a community of people, that the consciousness isn't originating from the brain itself. As a matter of fact, it could even be outside of our body totally. So I think that's really what's interesting to me. Even if it was a seizure you were having, the experience, the where does it come from? Probably not just being made up by your brain. It's something.
Well, the interesting thing too, since you brought up seizures specifically, is, you know, we're big in the looking into psi research and remote viewing and all this type of stuff. And we recently went down a little bit of a rabbit hole with channeling type things. And there actually is some research out there that ties that to potential seizures where they were doing like brain scans, MRI stuff. And again, you know, it's not like just because something like that may occur and could be classified as a medical event, something of the sort. Like that doesn't mean automatically that whatever information you received or whatever it is, therefore irrelevant, you know? Yeah.
It's also worth noting, I think it's fascinating. We talk about seizures specifically and how that does seem to kind of correlate a lot of times with experiences, whatever. Well, it's funny when you ask yourself, what's happening during a seizure? Well, actually what's happening is it can be defined as an electrical storm in your brain.
Yeah.
Basically. So electricity, that's interesting to me because the phenomenon itself seems to be able to manipulate electricity in a lot of ways. We have everything from gadgets failing, batteries draining, computers turning on, all this stuff. So if there's that going on in your brain at the time, that's sort of makes sense. It's also worth noting when you look at research of people that have seizures often. While we look at it, we're like, oh my God, this is a horrible, very bad experience. Look into what they are saying when they have them, like after this clarity they have, it's like a different kind of weird awakening. It's a very interesting rabbit hole to go down as people.
It is. And, you know, it brings up the whole concept of non-local consciousness, all kinds of things. Because once again, to bring it back to the fact that since quantum entanglement was proven in a lab, all of this has a different point of view scientifically. I mean, that's why I started Curious Research, was to prepare researchers in these communities to talk to scientists in the lingo that they use and the way that they use data, you know, and you know, to start calling it data, like start treating it dispassionately as data. It's okay to, it's all right. Yeah. Even if you experienced it, the dude in the lab experienced something too. He got excited. It still has to be proven by his buddies, you know, and it has to be looked at and it has to be looked at by other people. So the idea is, how do you prepare weekend warrior paranormal investigators, people who are out wood hunting for Sasquatch, things like that? How do you prepare them to prepare their data to meet science? And at the same time, how do you remind science of the beautiful open mind it takes to do things in science?
get rid of the corporate interest.
Sides. Yeah.
Yeah. You get rid of the corporate interest and you get rid of the funding challenge, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you try to get rid of the stigma. And I find it fascinating that people that are talking or debating with us about the phenomenon itself. And I really loathe when people say this. People that aren't scientists always say, well, exceptional claims require exceptional evidence or whatever. They're quoting some scientist they've heard. Yeah.
Carl Sagan.
Yes. And they make it for them. I think psychologically, it makes them feel like they're a part of that scientist group.
Sure.
So they feel very intelligent, but they're forgetting one thing. One of the basic tenets of the scientific method is if experiences are happening over and over and over and over and over to all these people across cultures, the phenomena exist, whether or not we know what
it is. That's right.
So to say like, oh, it's not been proven, so it's not repeatable in a materialist way, by the way, let's make that very clear that our method right now is based in the material sciences for repeatability. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, no, no, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Even in the Skinwalker Ranch communities, stuff like that, they get very upset about all the rockets. And it's like, oh, you're upset about all the repeatable science.
Yeah.
Wow. Right. Imagine that, you know, about all the actual data that whenever you do this, something happens. So that's why you keep doing it.
Yeah.
You know, when you get a result, you tend to keep poking it to see what more results you get. And I'll bring up one of my favorite books that I actually got at MUFON Symposium. This is actually a scientific desk reference called Strange Phenomena, and it goes through everything from like articles from the 1700s on swamp gas and ball lightning, things like that. I'm a big fan of the switch to UAP. It was sneakily done.
Are you a fan?
I'm a fan mainly because it brings science in kicking and screaming.
Fair enough.
In science, you must get rid of the phenomena. You have to get rid of the phenomena. You have to get rid of the anomaly in your data set. If I was making a solution and 10% of my two solutions that I put together disappeared by weight, did it off gas? Did it become sediment? What happened to the 10%?
If this continues
to happen, now we got an anomaly and we got to figure out what this 10% loss is about. That's science. So. Yeah. Once again, the idea of, and we get very attached to the pictures that we take, the audio we take, the videos we take, because they are from experience. But if we can get to the point of understanding that if what's in that red circle is proven that it doesn't remove the moment of experience, I think that is a huge hurdle within our communities.
I think the biggest hurdle is probably going to come down to, so we have this idea and we call it haunting ants. Okay. And I'll give you the Cliff's Notes, but let's say that you went today and you bought an ant farm, like in those little plastic cases. All right. You have it on your table and the ants are doing their thing. Well, let's say every day at a certain time, I don't know, you do something weird. Maybe you shake it, you shine a light in there, you do something weird. Well, here's what's interesting. You've now generated paranormal phenomena to these ants. Yes, if you reach in, you pick one out, you put it on a petri dish and you poke at it, you pick it back up, you put it back in. His little ant buddies are like, bro, like we were trying to build a tunnel. Like, where were you? And he's like, I don't know, man. Something came out of the sky, picked me up, touched me a little bit, and then put me back. You've just created an abduction experience. Now, ants in their world, they will never be able to understand our science. We know that for a fact.
Sure.
They'll never be able to. So I feel like we're the ants in this situation, yeah. And I just don't know if our understanding of science and the material world will ever be able to grasp it. So I think, and we've even seen that the phenomena itself will change things. You mentioned pictures in audio, and yeah, a lot of people in the community get very egotistical about it, and they collect it like baseball cards, you know, like, oh, look at this evidence. It's like an EVO, Ken Griffey Jr. card, rookie card. But the thing is, we have seen it where you'll have something on recording, video or audio, whatever. You go to show it to somebody and it's gone and then it'll come back. So that to me right there is almost like something telling you like.
Yeah. And we've had it happen repeatedly.
Over and over, over and over.
Wow. Wow. Now, amongst the investigations you guys have done, amongst the data that you guys have collected, what has been the most wow moment for both of you? Individually, please. Because, what? I mean, even though you investigate together, doesn't necessarily mean that the wow moment is the same for both of you. You know?
No, I think it is, actually. It's funny. The house that we live in, we have certainly haunted it through our experiments, et cetera.
Through trinkets alone.
Well, that probably. But I'll tell you, when you pulled up the website a little bit ago, you were on a video about it, and I would not play that video unless you tell your audience that there is a possibility of attachment. So it was the whistle, I would say. This thing, we went to this place, we investigated in Mineral Wells. Some people have probably heard of it. It's called Hill House. But the owners gave us an item from the house after our first investigation there. The night we were there, we kept hearing what sounded like someone whistling at us. Yeah, that's the video. You'll probably barely hear the audio if you try to play it here. But it's interesting because that whistle, once we brought that item home, it was in the house. Okay, now it started following us across state lines in other places that we were going. Okay, now we have countless messages from people that have either seen the item at events we speak at, or just listen to podcast episodes where we talk about it.
Yeah, we've had to start putting actual disclaimers on any of our podcast episodes where we talk about it.
Because they're getting the
as phenomenal. Well as anytime we speak at events. Because, yeah, literally, and I'm not exaggerating, I'm using literally in the actual sense of the word, every single time that we have ever spoken about it, whether it is on the podcast or, like, on a stage, I will get at least one message from somebody reaching out that it followed them home. Yeah. But usually it's many more than just one.
Yeah, all the time.
Wow. Wow. Now I kind of want to play it.
Well, you can. You certainly can. I will tell you the video, what it is Nicole was on the first floor of the house. Yep, you can see it. She's watching me on a screen. Yeah, you missed it. You just heard it. There it was. Did you hear it?
It's in the...
Okay.
And so when that happened, I was actually doing a live stream on TikTok at the time. That's how I have that video. And you hear the whistle in the video clip, obviously. And then you kind of hear me, because I don't like front loading up anything. Yeah. I'm also very skeptical. And so you hear me kind of murmur. I'm like, what the hell was that? And comments start coming in from other people being like, wait, it sounded like I heard a whistle. Wait, was that a whistle? And so later on in the clip, you hear me, you know, I'm like, okay, wait, so y'all heard that too? Okay, yeah. Good.
It was all throughout the night. We heard that thing. And that night is when we got this item. We took it home, and around the time we took the item home, that thing popped off like crazy. It was just always, there's right. Wow. Sometimes like right in front of your face, you'd hear it like, oh my God. So you just now played it.
We'll see if any attachment comes. And if anybody out there listening or watching tonight, begins to hear the whistle, let us know.
Please.
Yeah. DM us on Instagram at Pair Peculiar. Let me know.
I look at this as our own experiment here. To see if anything happens. And I'll let you honestly know if anything happens here, if my family begins to hear anything that they are not used to.
Oh, you got a family that you live with? That would just be great.
Like, oh, yeah. Hey, no, I have my 8-year-old son in the house. Oh, yeah. Well, he's 9 now. He's 9.
Yeah. I mean, it happened one of the times I went home too. I didn't tell my mom the story, but as I was leaving to fly back to Texas, I just mentioned, I was like, hey, just keep an ear out if you happen to hear a whistle at all, especially if you're alone, let me know. And sure enough, a few days later, she texted me. She was like, so I'm 99% sure I just heard a whistle in the house and I'm here by myself. Do I need to be concerned?
Yeah.
Like, just say hi.
Well, and what's wild, we talk about data. Now, the whistle, we'll call that, is what we refer to just as an observable, right? Like,
sure.
It is something that is, if you look at experiences going back to antiquity, that is something that happens, a whistle. I mean, there's even that old legend of don't whistle at night. If you hear whistling at night, don't whistle back.
Well, and don't follow the whistles.
Correct. And then we
don't follow the whistle.
And then it follows us, you know? Yeah. So it's interesting because there's really only, you can probably count on two hands, paranormal phenomena, like what there is the whistles, there's the knocks on the walls, disembodied voices, things like that. But there's not much. There's a few observables. Here's what's really interesting. That whistle, we've taken that recording, played it to recordings of other times that we've recorded the whistle, played it up next to other people that we know who had heard whistles and recorded it. And it sounds like you're listening to the exact same thing.
It's I am also a musician and can confirm it is the same note. So
that is fascinating to think about, especially the idea of it being places that it hadn't been reported in that kind of way. And following in that kind of way. Cause there was the whole issue with the Annabelle doll in the community over the last year or so. And the idea of, you know, whether or not that is haunted in the way that people claim it is, in the demonic way people claim it is, or if that haunting attaches to people in that kind of way.
We're Nicole giving it a kiss.
Yeah, I gave her awesome. A kiss. Forehead. No, I think a lot of that's just like mass hysteria, to be honest.
No, I think a lot of it's marketing.
Like the Louisiana fire that everybody was trying to say, like,
yes,
Annabelle did it. Like, it actually was not, she was not in.
Yeah, she was nowhere near there. She was there for like a weekend event or something like that.
Like, I'm just going to point this out. I'm not typically the guy that'll say stuff like this, but it's just blatantly obvious to me. The paranormal community or people that were saying that is all over Facebook. Oh my God, Annabelle, she caused the fires on the plantation. Oh, right. So it literally wasn't the spirits of all these slaves that were probably mistreated at some point. It's this doll. It's this Raggedy Ann doll. No.
I had to bring one up. And the only thing I commented on in the actual community, I took a snapshot of it and sent it to a group that my brother and my buddy from high school belong to, where it's just like five of us and we just share horrible memes and go, what the hell is going on in the world? Stuff like that. But it was a picture of this person's garage door covered in poop. All right. Now, I'm not joking, covered in poop. Like flung, there it is. And they're like, I've been gifting for years at my gifting station. Like the first place this person's brain goes to when they come out and find their garage door covered in poop is, thank God, Bigfoot has gifted me.
Okay.
Bigfoot has gifted, like that's where they went. Not like, hey, you know, there's some random kids, like, you know, teenage boys. I knew people that threw poop on things, man, you know, like that's just what they did. Forget the fact that it might be a mischievous teen. No. We immediately go to Bigfoot has gifted me back.
Yeah.
I am so blessed. And God bless you.
Those are the people who make the people who are trying to do actual, like, paranormal, you know, investigation look real bad. So anybody who does that, please leave.
It got even worse. So now, not only do you ask the question of, like, oh, could Annabelle be demonic? No, now what they're doing, and I will call this out because this is something I have no shame about calling out. They are now selling replicas
of Annabelle.
Of the Annabelle doll that have been sitting next to Annabelle.
Yeah.
And multiple people are buying them for their other haunted museums and taking them home. And
like,
okay, congratulations on your Raggedy Ann doll, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, that's
sorry, did we just do we sounded saucy there, so you know.
No. But that's just it. And this is one of the things that we have to caveat emptor within the communities. We always have to, I will always believe any experiencer that comes up to me with their story, I will believe them prima facie right off the get. Absolutely. I have had my experiences that are fully unexplainable. Other people were there. They did not experience them.
Yeah. That happens a lot.
You know, so am I crazy? Hell no. You know, I will listen to anybody. But when it comes to things like that, when it comes to these things that once again have been proven in communities, and where you have people taking advantage of people at ticketed events, that kind of thing. That's where you get into some snake oil in the communities. And if we don't call that out, even as researchers, if we're afraid to call that out on the carpet, woe be unto us in the future, I think, you know?
This is how bad the community is. We've had someone who's really in that world tell us, multiple people actually, tell us that if you insult Annabelle or whoever's housing Annabelle, that you're like persona non grata, you're like out of the paranormal community. I'm like, that is the most asinine thing I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah. Yeah, I would tend to agree.
Sorry if we just got you shadow banned.
That's okay. I'm a former on-air producer for Alex Jones. Believe me, that's the least of my shadow ban.
Great.
Hey, nice man, I just push buttons, dude. I just push buttons for a living, you know? But
speaking of, he actually, I'm just because you mentioned him.
No.
His stuff that he's saying that from his sources about the phenomenon itself are things that we are now starting to understand and people are now talking about. He was saying stuff about the phenomenon 10 years ago that people in Congress are now coming out and saying. And I find that fascinating.
Yep. And, you know, it was always interesting because there were a lot of hard lines. Like he would not talk UFOs on the show. At the time when I worked there, he would have certain people on, you know, and be like, somebody get me David Icke. this is the trend he's been talking about right now with gold. Somebody get me David Icke. Just tell him we aren't talking about lizard people today. There's no lizard people allowed.
Did you hear that they came out in Congress and said, I think it was...
There's a crossbreeding program.
Yes, and they actually mentioned the tall whites. They mentioned the lizard people, the mantis beings. Yeah. So it's a great time to be a conspiracy theorist because we can say we told them so.
It's all out there. It's all out there. And that's just it. And that's kind of, you know... bringing this home, that's kind of the idea behind not only your show, but your tour that you guys do, what y'all talk about, and the whole idea that all of these things are interconnected, whether it's the communities or the experiences, that there is some sort of connective ligament to all of this and the way it operates. So, before we let you guys go, let's get into the conference a little bit. How did it go? How was it received by the local community?
Yeah, it was good. Yeah. I mean, it's always, I feel like when you're putting on an event, when you see a bunch of people that you have never met before and you have no idea who they are, you're like, okay, I did something right. You know, people heard about it. People showed up. But yeah, it was great. We had a lot of people there for, you know, all of the speakers, all of the vendors really loved it. Everybody had a great time at the end of it. You know, they all came up and were like, okay, we're ready for next year. Like, we're going to come back. So awesome. It was really great. And it was also our first stop this year for the current iteration of the Haunted Road Show, where we have our items and stuff, but we've added a few special things. Like, we have little investigation stations. We have a scrying booth with our haunted mirror.
Our one of a kind investigative tools, right? And the feedback that we really got though was people really liked what we had done because we really put an emphasis on the talks and the presentations. We did not want like, oh, we've got such and such celebrity and a bunch of booths to go buy money. No, literally, we wanted good presentations that got people thinking. And that was the feedback we got. So if you're in Austin, so shout out to the Austin community because everyone came out in droves, had a great time. They loved it. There are two that go on in Austin, Strange and Extraordinary Fest, like we're talking about now, and Spirit Social, which is put on by Stephen of the Night Owl podcast here in Austin. And that's coming up. You have that coming up this year.
That's November 7th, which we're at that every year as well, supporting. He's a good friend of ours. So
awesome. Awesome. Well, guys, I want to thank y'all so much. It's been a fantastic conversation. I would love to have y'all on again and again and again, especially to talk about some of these issues within the para communities. That is a huge cause of our show. I try to explain our show best as we try to kind of demystify these topics for people who are not deep in these communities. These communities can get really thick, really fast. They can be very nebulous, and trying to get to the root of these topics, trying to get to the root of what builds these communities, I think is hugely and massively important, especially as we all move forward into, like you were saying, Damien, this new territory of, it's all interconnected.
Yeah. No, we couldn't agree more.
The age of Aquarius.
That's it. That's it. Well, before we let you go, shameless self-promotion time, where can people go to find out more about booking you guys to come with the Traveling Museum? Where can they go to find the podcast? Where can they go to find out more about the Strange and Extraordinary Fest here in town?
Right there on your screen, parapeculiarmuseum.com. You know, you can go there. You can listen to the Parapeculiar podcast. We have two podcasts, Parapeculiar and The Real Ghosts Of. One is our recordings from investigations. The Parapeculiar podcast is like deep dives, rabbit holes, talking to other people, really high strangeness. So you got two of those. There's the website. It's got everything you need there. You can contact us from there. Slide into our DMs on Instagrams and everything else.
Yeah, you can find us on Instagram at Parapeculiar. You can find us on anywhere you might summon your podcasts at Parapeculiar. And then for the fest, it's just under that same name, Strange and Extraordinary Fest. So on Instagram, strangeandextraordinaryfest.com. And yeah, I think that's all the things.
Yeah.
Well, fantastic, guys. Thank you all so much. Once again, I greatly appreciate it. We'll be in touch with links, all that kind of good stuff. Feel free to stay tuned for the next part on social media, all that kind of good stuff. I greatly appreciate having y'all on and can't wait to have you on for future discussions.
Radical. Yeah. You as well. Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Take care, guys. We'll be in touch soon. While you are online, everybody, checking out everything from the Parapeculiar podcast, as well as the Parapeculiar Haunted Museum at parapeculiarmuseum.com, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. If you were looking for the moon base announcement that happened today from NASA, we have all of those NASA feeds, everything else right there on our video channel. Stop on by curiousrealm.com/videos, and you can find not only all of our episodes, but also all of the declassified government panels, things like that, as well as all of the video channels from our guests. When we come back from this quick commercial break, we will be joined by our good friend Daniel Duke. We will be talking about his familial relationship to the outlaw Jesse James, his faking of his death, his move to Texas, and how his family came across a treasure map when we come back right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick commercial break. Thank you so much for staying with us. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you're a user of CBD products like I am, stop on by TrueHempScience.com today, folks. They are your source for amazing CBD products. Christopher Lynch and True Hemp Science use every part of the hemp plant. That is seeds, stems, buds, fibers, roots. Every part of the plant is used, combusted, and reused in an amazing process that turns out an awesome spigeric product, complete with terpene profiles and all. Stop on by their website. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get an edible on the way out the door. I have been using True Hemp Science for easily the last 6-7 years, and even traveling the country to dispensaries recreationally, folks, I have yet to find a CBD product that beats them out. Stop on by again. TrueHempScience.com is the website. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more. Our guest in this segment is Daniel Duke. He is the author of The Mysterious Life and Fake Death of Jesse James, as well as Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure. He is based right here in Texas, folks. He lives just up the road from me, and I love our conversations. It's been way too long since you have been on. Welcome back to the show, Daniel Duke. How are you this evening?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on again. This is awesome.
Man, it's always fun chatting with you, and I am remiss in actively getting myself up there to hang out with you and just enjoy a glass of whiskey and cook a steak on the campfire like you always are on social media.
Recently made a giant, talking about whiskey. Oh, this is from oak on the property. I made a little tumbler.
Nice.
charted on the inside. I made a shot glass, but I like the tumbler. You can drink more.
I was actively just asked the other day by my mother, actually. That's how well my mom knows me, Daniel. She asked me, she was like, you know, I've been tuning into your show a lot more lately. What's in that cup that you drink out of?
Yeah.
And I was like, honestly, it's typically either iced tea or Red Bull. Despite the decanters of whiskey and gin behind me, I was like, it's not dudes and beer anymore. Back in the days of dudes and beer, whenever you used to first come on, like, yeah, man, yeah. we would tear through beer. We would tear through whiskey on air. That was part of the conversation. But since then, things have been a little more ironed out. A little more wrinkle free, Daniel. The whole idea that Jesse James had faked his death. This is something that had been posited a while back, but this digs into so many different parts of mythos and American mythos and the way that these things happen, the way that they happen historically, and the way that we understand that they happen. So how did you first come to find out about the fake death of Jesse James? Let's start there before we get into treasure and Templar treasure and connection to the Templars.
Okay. Yeah. That started when I was a child. Just about every birthday or, you know, when the whole family would get together around Christmas or any of the holidays, somebody would always talk. We had a large family on my mom's side, and one of my uncles or aunts would always bring it up. And it was almost like it was brought up at most family get-togethers. And, I would just think, oh, cool, and run along and play. But as you grow older, a little more sticks, sticks with you, stays in your memory. And my mom grew up hearing the same thing. And it helped, us greatly if his diary was passed down through the family. It wasn't really a diary like he wrote his feelings. It was a day book. But that got passed down through the family, along with a treasure map and a whole bunch of photos and things, items that belonged to Jesse. But the day book had dates, names of known gang members, stuff like that. And that's why the oral tradition started as a child. And then I have to give all the credit to spearheading that to my late mother. She's the one, she wrote three books about it. She wanted to, once we were all in college, mom finally had time to research more. And she took the family photographs to the Texas Department of Public Safety, their headquarters down in Austin. And for people who don't know, that's Texas State Police, basically. Yep. Took it to the headquarters to their forensic department, and Karen Taylor and Missy Micheletti, Karen Taylor is very well known in the forensics world. She actually had, when mom was there, she had David Koresh's skull. Photos of his skull in there. She was verifying who he was. But she was a forensic artist, forensic expert. Anyway, long story short, those two verified that our family photos matched traditionally accepted photos of Jesse, not only Jesse, but his mother and the rest of his family members, like Frank, Dr. Samuel, Jesse and Frank's stepfather, and others. But we knew they looked alike. We knew the stories, but we needed qualified experts, highly qualified experts to verify whether they were or were not the same people. So we, they gave us great review. They, gave us the written letter, they wrote their findings down, signed it. We've got that, the verification. Went to Austin Police Department Photographic Forensic Lab, and they also verified that the photos matched. And mom took it to a third group. At the time, they were called Visionix. They were world leaders in recognition technology. And Visionix later purchased by a company called Identix. But anyway, they also verified the findings. So we had the photos, we had the family, the oral the oral story, the oral history. We were going to the Texas State Archives down in Austin constantly. It's almost like we were camping there. We were there constantly just doing research, and that's where some other stories in later. But yeah, it went from there. We census records, birth certificates, death certificates, all of that. And then the names in his diary, you research all those and you'd come to brick walls, but I don't want to jump ahead of myself or ahead of your questions, but that's how it started.
Well, and once again, to have that family history to begin with, something that was openly spoken about, that you were relative of Jesse James, things like that, is one thing. But to find the equivalent of a diary also is phenomenal. That's pretty amazing. Much less what you believe to be an actual treasure map, Daniel.
Yeah.
Now that's pretty wild claim. That's pretty big. What have you found along the way that leads you to the proof of the death or the fake death of Jesse James and him coming to Texas to begin with? B, what do you have so far as provenance for the map and diary?
All right. With the diary, as far as provenance, we've got his name. He signed his name, J. James, and JWJ was his initials, Jesse Woodson James. He also signed on the back cover, back in the front and back on the cover of the little day book. You could see where he practiced writing his alias, J.L. Courtney, James L. Courtney. He wrote it over and over. And I thought, who sits there and writes their name? I don't do that, like, constantly.
Yeah.
Just, only on the covers. It was like he was practicing writing his name. But anyway, he's also in the day book. He initials it J.W.J. and signs his name just J. James. So not Jesse, but J. James. So I thought, okay, there's that. And then you keep digging as you read through it. There's a known James gang members, and like Cole Younger, they called him Bud. That was his nickname. He mentions him by nickname. Never Cole Younger or Cole was here. But there were other names, Tom McDaniels and multiple other known gang members. Also, places when he would go on trips, he would mention, took a train from Marlin, Texas to Longview. Longview to Shreveport, Shreveport to Natchitoches. From Shreveport, he hopped a riverboat down to Natchitoches and then got off on the Louisiana side and went back north and stayed in a man's house. Everywhere he was on that trip, you can look up the old newspaper records. On the same date he was there, there was a robbery. Stage robberies, the steamship was robbed. Like everywhere they were.
Wow.
It was of that, And then the guy he stayed at, when I mentioned he stayed at a man's house, he mentioned that man. It was Gervais Font. Well, I thought, okay, every name that was mentioned, we researched in as much as we could. Did their genealogy, any other paperwork, contact family members, see if they had any stories or heard any legends. Gervais Fontenot, I found out it almost instantly, he was a retired U.S. Marshal. And I thought, why would Jesse stay at the home of a retired U.S. Marshal? And found out later that's where Freemasonry starts kicking in. A lot of the people he stayed with, they were also Freemasons. He was a Freemason as well. Then on top of that, Gervais Fontenot's, when I found his a very detailed family tree that his family had already done, he was the nephew of Jean Lafitte, the famous privateer/pirate.
Interesting.
And Jean Lafitte was also a Freemason. I didn't know this until, I started looking at Jean Lafitte. I thought, okay, what? This is odd. A pirate, an outlaw. How does this mix together? I started researching that. Jean Lafitte was a Mason. And that's, you can look up That's available in historical documents on the Grand Lodge of Louisiana's website and other sites.
Yeah,
it stated that he had Masonic communications with Andrew Jackson when Andrew Jackson was a general. And you can't have Masonic communications unless both parties are Masons.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And of course, you know, I just popped up on screen from Texas Highways, the legend of Jean Lafitte's treasure still being in Galveston to this day.
Yeah.
Not many people know that Jean Lafitte helped defend the port of Galveston. And was stationed there.
Yeah, I lived right after college. I lived in League City, halfway, you know, between Houston and Galveston. I went fishing almost every weekend in Galveston, and I would always wonder, you know, where they were, what was going on 100, 200 years ago, things like that. And I always that naturally brought up Jean Lafitte. I'd just wonder where he was, how many people, and like you said, most people don't seem to even know about that these days.
Yeah, and there is a very quiet historic marker all over Texas. We have historic markers, you know, things like you'll see a little sign says like historic marker 1 mile with an arrow.
Yeah.
But right there, as you go over the bridge to Galveston, coming from Houston off to the left, there is a small historic marker that commemorates Jean Lafitte. And there used to be a gentleman's club right there next to it. It used to crack me up for years. But it's like, hey, look, historic marker. And then the gentleman's club. But
Lafitte's ghost was probably walking around there all the time.
More than happy he was, I'm Living sure, to be right there.
That cracks me up.
But in all sincerity, these are things that have once again been legend in Texas for a long time. So the fact that your research actually tied Jesse James and his trip after faking his death to going to Louisiana and staying with a Masonic brother who was relative of Jean Lafitte, is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, that blew my mind. I thought, my God, I mean, this is, we're already proving, you know, Jesse James didn't die as history said, and he faked his death, lived out, you know, lived to be an old age in Texas. That's a handful on its own. And then you find out he stayed the night with Jean Lafitte's nephew.
Yeah.
And I thought, what is going on? And that was where things started. That was around the time we started figuring out there were a lot of, it was a network. It wasn't just old West outlaws riding around robbing things. There was a lot more to it. That was just a small part of a huge picture.
Yeah. But,
as far as Jesse goes, you know, we had that information, everywhere trips he took, everywhere he went, there were always robberies in the newspapers.
Yes.
Things like that. It was just once or twice. It's a coincidence, but when it happens constantly throughout the book, and the other thing, like he was well known for exchanging gold for cash.
Mm.
A guy who's on a 160-acre farm, what farmer in Reconstruction era Texas had the kind of money to swap out gold and, you know, gold for cash? It was like those, it reminds me of the gold for cash businesses around today.
Yeah.
You know, it takes some money to be able to do that. And during Reconstruction Texas, that would have been that was a rare find.
Yeah. Yeah. You'd have been probably much more common finding somebody exchanging that gold note for gold.
Yeah.
You know, changing in that $20 gold eagle. Than changing in the $20 gold eagle to go get paper money, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, that brings something up before we get too far and too hip deep into his actions in Texas and things like that, Daniel. His death specifically, because we've talked about this on the show before. St. Joseph, Missouri is the place that claims to be the home of the home where Jesse James was shot. Things like that. And it's one of those, this is the accepted history. This is what people have said for years, that he was shot in the back. But it's interesting that these crimes specifically carry his hallmark, and especially that chaotic hallmark, because that's really what he was. It was a run and gun style. It was a interrupt, create chaos. That's literally what the job of Quantrell's Raiders was when he was in the Civil War, was to go run in, raid, wreak havoc, and run out and leave them confused.
Exactly.
And
it was quick. It was like special forces operations. You ride in, or now they don't ride in, but you hit quick, create the chaos, and achieve your objective and get out.
Yeah, and that's pretty much the same way that his crimes played out. He did them very much in raid fashion, in that kind of way, continuing that. So to hear these hallmarks of his signature as far as the way a robbery was done, that it's following that trail. How did he go about, faking his death and getting down to Texas? Because like you said, it would take a network of people to do that. Granted, probably a little bit easier back in the day, back in the days of the old West, there were the rumors of Brushy Bill Roberts and stuff like that here in Texas as well.
Yeah.
Was supposedly also Billy the Kid. All kinds of things. And that the West was definitely full of people that had literally reinvented themselves, that came over from the East Coast, that were full on criminals and led a good farming life and started all anew,
It's true.
Texas specifically, and the Alamo was full of them. People who came over to change their way and find a crop of land with the Spanish land grant and start all over with a brand new name, So
that's true.
And granted, as we've said before, this town definitely has vested interest in the data in your book not getting out there, things like that, because if it ends up that he did fake his death, you're gonna lose a little bit of tourism money, things like that.
I can't tell you how many people had contacted my late mother saying just that, like almost pleading, like, don't you care about the people in St. Joseph?
Yeah.
And mom was like, well, don't you care about the people in Central Texas? I mean, it's not about money. It's about the truth. And for them, for a lot of people up in Missouri, it was about money. And then, that also, I think, is why a lot of when the death threats started coming, they were threatening my mom, my sister, and myself. The FBI got involved and put an end to it, fortunately. But it was about a dozen people, close to a dozen people, just under.
Wow.
But the guy they paid to do it, he was just a kid, and they had him doing it, and he was piggybacking off somebody else's Wi-Fi. It wasn't like he didn't do a good job of hiding his tracks, fortunately. But anyway, all of that came to an end. But I think I thought, why would they go through all of this trouble and pay a guy good money to send us death threats? And it got worse and worse. And anyway, I looked up the budget for Clay County, Missouri, and the James Farm specifically was bringing in around $7 million a year. And this was 20 years ago. Mm. I thought, if they're in a poor county, $7 million in a year is a lot of money for, especially in a poor area.
Yeah.
So. And I don't know. I don't know how much of that got out to the county and how much went to other people. But a lot of people who weren't officially involved were really upset about that money.
Well, and there's a couple other ties in there also, Daniel, that may have rung up those threats. When you're talking about possible connection to Templar treasure or artifacts, possible connection to money from the Knights of the Golden Circle. You know, the KJC, which was pretty much like the Knights Templar, but for the Confederacy.
Exactly.
All kinds of things. All these things still reach into the modern era. They still have a thread that is lined with gold. You know, whenever you start looking at Masons and things like that, and if Masons were involved with helping hide gold treasure or even Jesse James, you can bet that there would be something like that would go on. And to that fact, while you and your mother were researching at the Texas State Library here in Austin, you guys had run in like that.
Yeah. Yeah. That was one of many, but that was one of our first. And it was odd. We'd never been followed before. We noticed these two guys following us before we even noticed them. The head librarian, who at the time, the late David Baskins, he warned us, you know, he would tell every time we entered the archives, he'd say, make sure you sign in. Well, one day Mom and I walk in and he whispered to us, don't sign your names. And Mom said, why not? You know, it looked kind of funny. He was a friendly guy, but we looked at him like, why not? And Mom asked him why not. He said, they're watching. And I said, who? And he just turned around and walked off. And I thought, okay, this is odd. Who's watching? And we went on about our business, and it was an elderly gentleman and a younger guy, both watching us, the late Jay Harrison. And I believe the younger guy, Jeff Adams, is still alive. He was with the he handed me his card. He lied to us the first time. Second meeting, he handed me his card and told me what he claimed his real name was Jeff Adams. Handed me his business card. He was a researcher for the Texas State Bar. And I thought, okay, so I got home, got on the internet and checked it out, and he was. Now I can't find any record of him. When I look for him on the Texas State Bar, there's no record of him. I don't know if it was temporary thing, but the only record I found of him is he was working for Baylor University as a missionary, going into Mexico, investigating like child abuse cases. And I thought, what kind of missionary does that? I don't know. I'm not a missionary, so... You know, and I've never done that, so I don't know, but it just seems like an odd thing for a missionary to do.
Yeah. Yeah, that is.
Anyway, that's the whole side story, but it was just, it helps paint the picture of the shady, the odd stuff. Jay Harrison, he was allegedly, he told us he was a former policeman who was a block away from JFK when he was assassinated. And he was the one who Jeff stood there. Jay, the older gentleman, the former cop from Dallas, he's the one who gave us the warnings. And he also told us he was related to the Bush family, cousins. He said, you can prove who your grandfather was. Just don't ever mention any names that tie in with the Texas power structure. And Mom and I looked at each other. And she asked, well, who's the Texas power structure? And, you know, when you grow up in rural Texas in a little country town, you don't think about, we didn't think about those kind of things.
Yeah.
And he just grinned, kind of laughed and said, you'll find out. Nobody ever contacted us to tell us, hey, we're from the Texas power structure. But we found eventually, I believe it tied in with the Masons and other politicians. Knowing that he was a cousin of the Bush family, George Bush and Bush Jr., I think that could have played a large role in it as well. I don't know. They never came out and told us anything, but we were followed. We you know, just doing our research, you'd notice the same car and the same couple in a car following us in Austin, and then later on down the road in Cedar Park at Sonic getting a drink. They'd pull in across from us, just watch us. And when we left, they would leave.
Wow.
And it was just odd. Just odd thing. No danger. Nothing ever happened to us that, you know, nobody broke into the house or anything like that. So I'm not sure what that was about. It was just, maybe it was just to spook us. I don't know.
Well, yeah. Yeah. And like the guy said, don't excuse me, don't mention anybody that is connected with the Texas power structure. And when you start thinking about those things, when you start thinking about that kind of stuff, like, yeah, there were some nefarious people once again that came to Texas, came and were part of the founding of Texas. I mean, one of those people is literally, one of the ranchers from the Lincoln County Wars. You know, in New Mexico, that Billy the Kid and everything else was caught up in. Mm. So, like, people like that who were known for just straight killing somebody in the name of business. Like, sorry, Jack. There was next to no compunction with some people for such things.
Well, some of the guys I always call him Grandpa in Jesse's day book. Some of the names he mentioned, John and Bill Hitson. They were some of the biggest cattlemen in Texas in that day. When you said that, that reminded me of them. They had cattle in New Mexico stolen by Comancheros and other rustlers, cattle rustlers. So they hired 150 gunmen to ride into New Mexico, and they sent warning ahead before they got there, basically telling people, don't get in our way. We're getting our cattle. Don't get in our way or else. You know, that's just how it was back then. But they were, he listed their names in his day book, their name and address. You know, he didn't write the whole address. It was John and Bill Hitson, Palo Pinto. And that was where their headquarters were.
Well,
but it was.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to mentioning the Texas power structure and those guys after they, you know, that kind of stuff was still going on. Every time we went to the archives, we were watched. And around that time, Wagner Carr, former attorney general for the state of Texas, started calling Mom, and they talked. At first, they argued a lot, and then he ended up wanting her to write his autobiography. It was very, she said, I don't have time to do that. I'm working on this book. And, they ended up becoming friends, you know, or polite to each other anyway. And he was really interested in Jesse and mostly the treasures. And he sent his driver out to take Mom and I to three treasure sites where they had been recovered.
Oh, wow.
The Texas one is over in Georgetown off Highway 29 on the west side of Georgetown. There's an apartment complex on top of it right now. It's fairly new. It's about a year or maybe 2 years old. They built an apartment complex on top of where the cave was. But anyway, he said the Texas Rangers oversaw the recovery of the treasure. And I asked him where did they take it? And he never would answer me. I didn't expect an answer, but I had to ask. Another one was over in Academy, Little River Academy. And then there's one over by Prairie Dale. You know where Prairie Dale is?
Yeah.
Not on the map now. But anyway, it was three locations where large treasures were recovered. And according to his driver, she was there while the recovery was happening. She said she was talking about how the Texas Rangers were lined all off the side of the road. They had a landing pad for a helicopter that they stacked tight. They put the lights so it only would come and go at night. So they put lights on the ground and they stacked tires on it so you couldn't see the lights from the road. You could only see them from the air. And I thought that's pretty smart. But anyway, she said, and Wagner Carr verified, the driver told us, and then we talked to Wagner again, and she said it wasn't Pretty Boy Floyd. It was one of the other gangsters, not Machine Gun. It might have been Pretty Boy Floyd, one of those gangsters. I think I'll have to look at my notes again. But anyway, when he would go to San Antone, he would make a deposit there, not a withdrawal. He would stop at that catch and make a deposit. And she said there were, and Wagner had verified it, there were in the treasure, there were like old mail pouches. There were more modern coins from the early 1900s and Spanish gold bars.
Oh, wow.
So it sounds to me like it. And the funny thing about that is that matches the exact story of Victoria Peak, New Mexico. When they found the alleged billions in gold in Victoria Peak, New Mexico, it allegedly had Pony Express mail packages, you know, like mail pouches, and Spanish gold and more recent gold, as well as trunks with like a tiara and stuff like that in it. Different dates throughout.
Fascinating.
The dates range. I can't talk right now. It's like that's my tongue keeps getting. The dates were, you know, they ranged over several centuries, and it was like a long term depository. That to me, if that's true, that has to be a network of people depositing treasures over centuries. And I can't think of any other groups that would have done that other than Catholic Church could have done it. It could have been Catholic Masons, could have been Masons, could have been Templar, could have been, there's any number, but it had to have been an organized group of people doing something like that. And either when you take that into account and you know it's that old, that predates the Knights of the Golden Circle by centuries.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that and other evidence similar to that led me to believe the Knights of the Golden Circle played, if they played a role in it, it was an extremely small, short-lived role. Well, and I do think the KGC may have been like a puppet of the Masons.
Okay. And I could possibly see that in some routes. And, you know, especially whenever you're talking about, once again, getting away, even at that point, you know, even whenever you're talking about people like Billy the Kid, stuff like that, you had to have people sympathetic to you and your cause. You had to have people who were willing to go to prison if they were found hiding you. You know, if someone like a Pat Boone or someone like that crept up on you and followed your trail and found you in old Mexico or in the swamps of Louisiana, what have you. So the fact that it would take a network of people to get away in that kind of way, I think his belonging to the Knights of the Golden Circle has a big part to do with that. And having that network of people, once again, being a Mason, you have that network of people, you have that brotherhood that you can contact and chat with. And when you start looking at some of the things inside of, Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure, there is some fascinating stuff in there, especially once you start getting into the actual symbols and things like that used in Knights of the Golden Circle, which are here in the book. And when you start considering some of that, when you start considering some of the codes, letters, communications, that kind of thing, it very well could have been the fact that he was squirreled away and sent away with the treasure to later help the KJC rise again, so to speak, as the South always said they would.
Yeah, that's true. I've heard I've heard people claim that there's all kinds of claims, but I've heard people when I first started finding out about the treasure template, like they call it the KGC treasure template. And I found out later, I don't believe it is. I think it's a Masonic treasure template. And I think it's much older than Freemasonry. In my opinion, my theory is it came from the Templar. And a funny thing about that is in the Temple Round in London, on their Western door, it's an ancient door. The ironwork on that door matches the template. And I show that in the book as well. But what was I getting at? There's so many rabbit holes that goes off of this. And I feel like in the back of my mind, I keep remembering you asked me about him faking his death. Mm. Somehow I got off on the treasure stories.
But, we got into that because, well, the treasure is what came from the faking of his death.
Yeah. You know? Well, on let's see, if you want, I can go into the faking of his death.
Sure.
Okay. When, you know, we wondered about that. That's the biggest question. I mean, it's traditional history states he died as, you know, he was shot in the back of the head by Bob and Charlie Fort. So we thought, okay, how is it that he could, you know, how did this happen? We've got the photographic evidence. We've got his diary, the treasure map that he left, all this evidence, known gang members all around him living in Blevins, Texas. How did he do this? And the picture of that picture right there, we believe that's Wood Height, his first cousin. Wood Height, and if you look at that picture, the guy in the casket does not look, he doesn't look like photos of Jesse James. Now, people will say, well, he'd been dead a few days and he bloated and this and that. He still doesn't look like Jesse. But the thing is, let's see. We start combing over, you know, you have to look at it or approach it like you're a detective. It's a detective story. And you're trying to find out, okay, how did he fake his death? And if so, how? So we start with the coroner's inquisition. You read in the inquisition, his wife, alleged wife, Z Mims, who we believe was, she was actually married to Wood Height, not Jesse. Z, when she was questioned, they said, did he have a finger missing? She didn't know. She'd allegedly been married to him for years and had two children with him, yet didn't know if he was missing a finger or not. That seems odd. She didn't know exactly how old he was. Things like that. She didn't know anything. She had no answers for details, yet she knew in great detail every piece of jewelry that was in her house after the man was allegedly shot in the house in St. Joe. I mean, she was talking, she mentioned numbers or the inscriptions on the back of rings. She knew all about her jewelry, but she couldn't remember anything about her alleged husband. So there's that. That's not proof. It's just interesting. So they got Jesse's mother, brought her up by train from Kearney, Missouri to St. Joe to identify the body. She walks in. Her first words are, gentlemen, you are mistaken. That is not my son. And then she walks out onto the porch along with two women from the family and then came back in screaming and yelling and putting on a show, you know, cursing them. You killed my baby, things like that. And then so there's that. The coroner's inquest, they claimed that Bob and Charlie Fort, for example, they claimed that he was dusting a sampler, which, you know, those it's said like a home sweet home kind of thing on the wall. They called them samplers.
Sure.
He got on a chair, was dusting a sampler on the wall, and they stood. They were about 6 feet from him. Extended his arm with a .44 and shot him in the back of the head.
Yep.
That's the end of Jesse, allegedly. Then they turn themselves in. So while they're in jail, there's a funeral going. They were released, but during the funeral, I'm starting to skip around because I'm going mentally over the way I was reading through this. Anyway, so at the funeral, at the farm where he grew up in Kearney, Missouri, they buried the body in the front yard, and Jesse's aunt said, that's not the Jesse I knew. And there's reporters everywhere. People heard this, they reported it, and Jesse's mother, Zerelda, said, she hushed her. She said, that's my rabbit's foot. What mother calls their dead son a rabbit's foot? A lucky charm.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's little things like that. So back to Bob and Charlie. They, you know, they were 6 feet from him, extended their arm, a 44 caliber pistol, shot to the back of the head.
Which if you know, I'm no forensic scientist, you know, I don't work in a morgue, things like that, Daniel. But when you look at the picture of his face in the coffin, if you were shot with the 1890s 44 caliber pistol from 6 feet away in the back of your head.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's necessarily how clean you'd look. You know what I mean?
Well, there was a firearms expert she was in, I can't remember what branch of law enforcement she was in, but a firearms expert from New Mexico was curious about that. She researched it, and she said the same thing you just said. So she researched it just to show that it wasn't. She said he wouldn't have had a face.
Yeah, yeah.
It would have been. And the thing is, whoever the guy in the casket who was shot in the back of the head, the bullet never left his head.
And
a 44 would have gone through his head and through the wall. Now, the funny thing is, if you go to St. Joe, Missouri, and you visit the home where he was allegedly assassinated, they've got a hole in the wall. No hole. And according to all the reports in the coroner's report, the bullet didn't leave his head. So they were doctoring things up. The other thing about that whole story of how it happened, you would have to be a very short person to need a chair in that little room. It had a very low ceiling. I could reach up. I'm 6 foot, but I could reach up just over my head, just a few inches up. The ceiling was right over my head. It's a low ceiling. He was a tall man. He wouldn't need a chair. And even if he wasn't a tall man, he wouldn't have needed a chair. All he would have had to have done was walk up to the sampler with the duster and dust it off. Yeah. But they said he got on the whole thing. And I think they said he was on a chair to explain the angle. Now, the story on how Wood Height got killed, who we think is the real man who was dead in the pictures and passed off as Jesse. Wood Height was married to Z Mims. He thought of himself as a ladies' man, and he got around. He was mixed up in an affair with Bob and Charlie's sister, Martha Bolton. Martha Bolton lived in a farm in that area, that region. And she was also sleeping with her farmhand, Jim Gibson, a man by the name of Jim Gibson. So Wood Height shows up. Jim's there. Jim and Wood get in a fight. Wood shot and killed Jim Gibson. That's the end of the farmhand. Bob and Charlie shot Wood. And that was the end of him. Now, I don't know how accurate the shooting was, like where he was, where he was in the house when they shot him.
Sure.
But on the movie, Dirty Little Coward Who Shot Mr. Howard, I think that was The Assassination of Jesse James. In that movie, they showed Wood running up the stairs, and he was shot while he was running up the stairs, which would have been the same angle roughly as if he'd been standing on a chair dusting a sampler. So anyway, that's why I think they claimed he was on a chair just to maybe explain the angle of the wound. I don't know. I don't know if they even put that much thought into it, but I do know Wood Height was killed by Bob and Charlie Ford. Jim Gibson's grave was never found. They claimed they buried him in a shallow grave. I think the shallow grave was Wood Height. Wood Height's bones were allegedly found months later after the alleged assassination of Jesse. Oh, and they said they buried him in a shallow grave because the ground was too frozen to dig a grave.
Hmm.
So it was frozen. That preserves the body well enough to wait a month or 3 to 4 weeks, maybe a little more, and then pass it off as Jesse. Anyway, there's no known grave of Wood Height. And Wood Height came from a well-to-do family in Kentucky. They would have buried their son, and they loved him. It wasn't like they disowned him. They loved him, thought highly of him. And none of it added up. None of it. The photos and they said, if you'll look at those photos, there's other photos of the body laying on a table, and you can see his wrist real clear. There's bruises. It looks like his hands and wrists are swollen. And there's a lot of different excuses I've heard about that. Oh, it was bloating of the body and this and that. It looked like his wrists were bruised, maybe from being in a fight with the farmhand. I don't know. It's just, there's nothing about it matches. Also, other experts have said that the burial picture does not match the photo of the traditionally accepted photos of Jesse James when he was alive. And that falls in line with, we've got three of the best known experts in America who have verified our photos. We also later, now here comes the other part. 1995 in Kearney, Missouri, they had an exhumation. They paid Professor James Starrs, who was a law professor at Georgetown University. He wasn't a forensic scientist at all. He's a law professor. They paid him to dig up the grave, to exhume the body of Jesse in Kearney, Missouri, and prove once and for all that Jesse was killed in 1882. When he dug up the grave, there was multiple bodies in that grave, as a man's bones and female bones.
Oh, wow.
The coffin that they exhumed didn't match the coffin from the burial, from the description of the coffin when they reburied him. He was originally buried at James Farm, on his family farm, in 1902 during a rainy day. And this is important also. It was a heavy downpour. They exhumed the body and moved him. It was Frank and the family exhumed the body and moved it by wagon to Kearney, the Mount Olivet Cemetery in Kearney. It was a few miles, like 2 miles away. The casket disintegrated and fell apart. So they got another casket, supposedly a metal casket, and put his body in there and then reburied it. Well, 1902, that was 20 years later, after the alleged assassination, he was dug up and moved to Mount Olivet Cemetery. The casket falls apart, the body falls out. It would have been a skeleton by then.
Yeah.
They put it in a new casket, rebury it. The new casket was metal. The casket they dug up wasn't metal. It had metal handles, but it wasn't metal.
Interesting.
Also, the other part of that, the body was found anatomically correct, yet facing down. And I remember Professor Starr said facing the proverbial flames of hell, you know, something. He was always he was constantly speaking like he was trying to come up with headlines,
right?
But anyway, it was a skeleton when it fell out and the coffin crumbled. Why would it be anatomically correct? All the toe bones, finger bone, everything anatomically correct. Yet, and why was there a woman's body in the same grave? Nothing matched. Stephen Caruso, who was a Clay County district attorney or Clay County attorney, we interviewed him. He told us he had possession of the hair. It was a lock of Jesse's hair from the museum and Tupperware bowl full of some of his bones that were allegedly dug up in 1978 near the grave, which is another clue. How could it have been anatomically correct if they had bones of his in a Tupperware bowl that was dug up in 1978 by the curator of the museum at the time? So that guy would hand bones out to the friend, to different friends and people he liked, wanted to impress. So there's cross-contamination right there. There was no strict chain of custody. It was just a curator digging around in the yard. It was a hog tooth, a dog tooth, and several other teeth, human teeth, along with some other bones of mixed origin in a Tupperware bowl. So they couldn't get any DNA from the grave that they exhumed in Kearney. So he got a court. Professor Starrs got a court order to get the bones from the Tupperware, a tooth. So that was in possession of Stephen Caruso, the county attorney. And I hope I'm keeping this straight, not confusing.
That's all right.
Anyway, the attorney, Stephen Caruso, didn't like anything to do with it. He said the whole thing was a tawdry sideshow and he wanted nothing to do with it. They ordered him to hand over a sample of the hair and the tooth. He said his friend John Hartman, who was a Clay County Parks director, he pulled the hair out of his head and put it in an envelope and submitted that. And he said, "I assure you, the tooth we submitted had similar origins." He never turned in what they asked, what they ordered him to. He turned in somebody else's tooth. Well, Professor Starrs claimed the tooth matched DNA of a known descendant of Jesse's mother. And the hair also matched everything they knew about Jesse using hair dye and this and that. None of it came. The hair came from John Hartman's head. We have the the testimony of the witness who handed it over told us that he pulled the hair out of his friend's head. And it was a joke with them because his friend never told anybody he dyed his hair, and they found hair dye on the hair. So he always gave him a hard time after that. But anyway, he said it was their little joke for a while before he came out with it. Anyway, so there's no strict chain of custody on the DNA. They claim they proved it with DNA. The DNA they tested from a tooth of unknown origins, no strict chain of custody. It didn't come from the grave like Professor Starr said. Mm. And why did they have a professor of law doing it instead of a forensics expert?
Yeah.
None of that makes sense. It was, and like Caruso said, it was a tawdry sideshow. And I could go on little details on the entire thing. Nothing matches.
Well, and when you're talking about all these details specifically, like you said, it becomes a tawdry sideshow because it's obfuscation after obfuscation after obfuscation of things. It does become hard to track that down. It does become hard to find things. But once again, once you've shown the fact that the, like you said in the beginning, when images were brought forth to image experts here in Texas, some of the foremost, they said that it is Jesse James that's standing there, that it's, he is not the person in the coffin. You have pretty much diary evidence that shows he came here to Texas. You have what you believe to be a treasure map. At what point do you go search for the treasure, Daniel? In these last few minutes, we got you for about another 5-10 minutes. But okay. At what point are you treasure bound? Because I mean, once again, it seems like that may be why people threatened you and threatened your family, as you may be tied to something or even onto something else. That once again, money's tied to this, treasure tied to this, was possibly tied to somebody's onboarding into the Texas power structure during that time. Stuff like that.
The map he left, it wasn't like a typical treasure map, like what we expect. You know, growing up, you see pirate movies with a treasure map and it's, a little dotted line over from a, anyway, it wasn't like 40 paces from the oak tree.
Yeah.
It was geometric designs. It had a picture of what looked like the sun with a mean face on it. And then a crescent moon, there was dotted lines, dashed lines, solid lines, and then he wrote in code. Some of the code was easy to decipher. Some of it wasn't. The code that he wrote on there was, he would write it. Well, he would write like this many dollars worth of, and then he'd write it in code. And it, when you decipher it, it's silver. All he was doing on that was substituting letters for numbers. Sometimes he'd do it, like A is 1, B is 2. Other times he'd reverse it. Other times he would flip it around where Z was 1. That was pretty easy to decipher. He had so much in gold, so much in silver and cash. And then there was a letter from the family that had been passed down. He had buried some treasure in a cement. They were calling it a cement ball. I don't think it was a ball. I think it was more like a vault. But anyway, the way it sat, from what I could tell, it sounds more like a vault. But anyway, he said, I buried that where none of my family will ever find it. Because after he died, they dug up a lot of gold, quart jars full of gold, tin buckets full of gold. There was gold in the hollow tree, stuff like that.
Wow.
He also had cash in the walls, greenbacks in the walls in his house. And they found that too. He had 50,000 in greenbacks that he made one of his sons, Byron, count every night before he'd go to bed. When Byron was growing up, he had to count the money.
Wow.
Stuff like that. He would, 50,000. What kind of farmer has 50,000 in cash sitting in his house in a trunk? And gold buried under fence posts, things like that. The anyway, so long story short, the template, I found out the scale of the template after Wagner Car's driver showed us the three locations where it was recovered. That was what I needed to find out the scale. I made a transparency. I overlaid it on Google Earth. It lined up with those three spots in the center of the template, was right on top of where Jesse's house was.
Wow.
Outside of Evans, Texas. So I thought, okay. And it also lined up with an additional treasure site that George Roaming, he was a World War II vet, real nice old guy, had some wild stories. But anyway, he told us where, when he was a kid, Jesse was old. It was before he ran away to go fight in World War II, George. Jesse was an old man. Jesse hired him and swore him to an oath. And he helped Jesse move 600, it was 700 bars of gold. Jesse kept 20 and they buried 680 bars at Lake Belton. What's now Lake Belton? It wasn't a lake at the time. It was just Cow Creek running into the Lake River. But since then, in 1954, I believe the lake was created. So we went looked for that. George wrote the map of exactly where it, drew a map of exactly where it was for us. We started to go there. It's on Fort Hood. We're not crossing into Fort Hood. It's like, nope, not doing that. Plus, they probably already have it. There were other treasures, like in Oklahoma. We figured out where one probably was, and I think we were close. We're pretty sure we were close. We didn't tell anybody. It was me, Mom, and Dad. We drove to Oklahoma. We had permission to look on the property. We're on the property. Found out the property we were on, we believe, wasn't the right property. It was very close to where we were, but we weren't right on it. We leave. We were with plans to come back immediately. We get to the house. Right when we walked in the house, within 10 minutes, phone rings. And it was this strange guy. I think I'd told you about him in other interviews. His name was Matt. He was claimed they watch us all the time. He calls and he says, "That's not yours." Mom said, "How did you know?" And he said, "That's not important. That's not yours. That's not meant for you. Don't go back." That's kind of spooky. When you don't tell a soul, they tracked us. I don't know if they tracked us through our phones or how, but they seemed to know everything we were always doing. He would call over the years and tell us things that would be on the, he'd say, "This is going to happen in a few days." 2 or 3 days later, exactly what he said was on the evening, the national news, things like that.
Wow.
The death threats, for example, when the death threats were happening, the FBI agent would call. We didn't even know he was going to call. Matt would call this and say, "The FBI agent's going to call you in about an hour, and this is what he's going to say." And we thought, okay, this is odd. Well, how would he know? He never would answer our questions. So after a while, you learn, don't even ask, because they're talking in riddles and you don't really know. But anyway, he'd say he's going to call and this is what he's going to say. An hour later, the agent would call and he'd said verbatim what Matt said he was going to say. So you start wondering what kind of person is following you, knows everything you're doing, and knows exactly what a federal agent is going to tell you an hour before he tells you. It's just creepy. That's the kind of stuff that makes you wonder. And he would say stuff like, we would never hurt you. And then later on, he'd say something like, "We'd hate to hurt you."
Yeah.
So you don't know if they would or not.
Man, that is just truly wild.
One last little bit on that.
Sure.
And I'll shut up after that. He claimed there were a group called the Black Friars, who were also part of the former P2 Lodge in Italy. And if you know anything about the P2 Lodge, that was a Masonic lodge that was disbanded. They allegedly killed the banker for the Vatican in the 70s, Roberto Calvi, and hung him from Blackfriar Bridge. And they, according to Matt, they also, one of the names they call themselves are the Black Friars. I don't know anything about it. I've tried to find things about it and that kind of thing. There may be somebody out there may know more about it. I have no information other than that. But that's the kind of stuff that's always been in the background for the last 25, 30 years. And it just makes you wonder, we're not dead yet, so I guess we've been doing okay.
Yeah. Dan, truly, it is an evolving mystery, and one that I think, you know, hopefully someday you will have full answers. You will be able to research all of this to the fullest extent. But what you have so far is absolutely fascinating and awesome, and quite obviously has rippled a couple of things and ruffled a couple of feathers. So, thank you as always for coming on, sharing this incredible story, sharing your family's experience with it, everything else in such an honest and candid way. I always love our conversations. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can get their copy of Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure, as well as the mysterious life and fake death of Jesse James.
Any more books are sold. You can get Amazon, Barnes and Noble, Simon and Schuster. Anywhere books are sold around the globe.
Absolutely. Probably not.
I'm not sure if you can find it in China, but I know you can find it. I always wonder, in China or Russia? I don't know. But,
yeah. Good question.
I asked them, I said, where are my books? They said, it's anywhere books are sold. So,
all right.
They're all over the place.
Well, and once again, I want to thank you as always for coming on the show, taking the time to share this incredible, incredible story. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience, Daniel.
Okay.
While you are online, everybody, checking out everything by Daniel Duke over at authordanielduke.com. Make sure to stop on by Curious Realm, curiousrealm.com/stories, where you can find not only Daniel's books right there, but tons of books, guests, music, their classes, their videos, all kinds of things right there at curiousrealm.com/store, as well as your link to the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log. If you are a researcher into the world of paranormal, cryptozoology, UFO, UAP, if you are out taking witness testimonies in the field, things like that, the Field Observation and Encounter Log is your way to enter in all of your field work data into one common location in a scientific way so that your data is ready to shake hands with science come the day that you need to do so. Thank you so much, as always, everybody, for your open hearts, your open minds. Without that, the conversation does not happen, and without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.